copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
My name is Stefan Gustafsson. I come from Stockholm, Sweden, and I work as an apologist or evangelist apologist. It's my main calling, and I work in the very secular setting of Sweden primarily, but also travel to other places in Europe. And we have the theme of the art of answering questions. If you share the gospel, there will of course be questions of different kinds. And we know in the New Testament we are encouraged to really develop our skills to dialogue with people and answer questions. So in Colossians 4, chapter 6, Paul says, "Let your conversation be always full of grace, seasoned with salt, so that you may know how to answer everyone." And of course, you do not know that from the start or by yourself or automatically. Of course, we need to be dependent upon the Holy Spirit, but we need also to train ourselves and grow and learn. How can we answer people's questions? There will be questions in many different contexts, in your own home, a friend or a relative, someone in the family who is not a Christian, asking a question, so a very personal setting, or a neighbor or someone you work together with and you have a dialogue and there's suddenly a question. Or as evangelists, of course, there will be a number of settings which is very public. You are standing in front of a group of people, small or large, and there is a Q&A and there are questions. And we need to develop a skill to how to answer. And we need to help each other, learn from each other and inspire each other. And of course, then we need to be, not copy each other, be true to who we are and do our own thing. But still, you can learn so much from other people. So, let's get started with a question. And I will let you do some work here. So, discuss in small groups different ways to respond to the following objection raised after, for example, an evangelistic presentation. So someone is hearing you sharing the Christian faith and is then saying this: "But we don't have any hard evidence for God or Christianity. Science has not been able to prove these kinds of truth claims." I think you agree on that. "Different cultures just give different answers because no one can prove it." So in this situation, and here's the question, isn't the wise thing to remain agnostic instead of taking a blind step of faith in one direction, for example, your direction as a Christian? I will at this point not listen to your different answers to this question. Maybe we can come back to it if we have time. I just wanted to warm you up to the whole issue of asking questions. And this is an answering question. And this is a common question. So, the art of answering questions. What can be said about that? I first want to point out that Jesus seemed to love dialogue and conversation and even debates. You study the Gospels and you find some really interesting thing. For example, if you search in the four Gospels for the word ask and asked, they will show up 303 times. It's dialogues all over on every page in the Gospels. Answer or answered 145 times. You search for the word preach, you will find just a few places where that is at or taught. So the main thing in the Gospel is actually dialogues going back and forth all the time. Jesus loved to be in conversation with people. If you study the last week of Jesus in Matthew 22, there are four public debates in the temple in Jerusalem. some of them kind of aggressive against Jesus. But he enters the debate and he wins them all. We are called to use Francis Schaeffer's phrase to give honest answers to honest questions. If someone really have a question and they honestly wonders about this, we should try to give an honest and a well thought out answer to that question. What to do with dishonest questions? Of course, a lot of questions are dishonest. Well, there we have a choice. We can see that Jesus, when he was received a dishonest question, sometimes he's answering them, but sometimes he refuses to go into the debate. In Matthew 21, verse 23 to 27, the elders are approaching Jesus with the question, with what authority did you cleanse the temple? That's the issue. And Jesus knew they were not really interested in the answer. So he asks questions to test them. Are you really interested of the truth? Or is this a power play between you and me? So he asks the question and he says, I will also ask you one question. If you answer that, I will answer your question. With what John's baptism, where did it come from? So what do you think about John the Baptist? And the test comes out very clearly. The issue is, of course, was John sent from heaven or did he speak just from himself? Was it of human origin? And the elders discussed by themselves and then say, if we say from heaven, he will ask, then why didn't you believe him? But if we say of human origin, we are afraid of the people, for they all hold that John was a prophet. So they answer Jesus, we don't know. You know, they show they are not really interested in truth. They are not pressing on for truth. And then in this case, Jesus says, sorry. Then I will not answer your question. So here we have a choice. Honest questions, always an honest answer. If it's obvious and a dishonest question, sometimes the wise thing is to try to show for people, challenge them, is this a real question? Or what's going on here? Thinking about answering questions, I think we should not only think about specific questions, how to deal with that, but also think about strategies behind our answers. And I will give you a number of concrete answers to common questions, but try to show you the strategy behind how I would usually try to answer the question. So here is not the most popular question for us as evangelists, but you, at least in a student context today, you cannot share the gospel without this coming back as an issue. What do you think about homosexuality? If this is in a session which actually about the God's existence or science and faith or the resurrection of Jesus, of course you can say, very important question, I'm happy to discuss that. But actually, this is a session on the resurrection of Jesus. So you can talk to me afterwards, because if we go into that, all time will go for that issue. So there are some contexts where you have the freedom not to answer it. But there are other contexts where we have to answer the question, what to do. Well, the strategy I think we need to have here is to deconstruct the prejudices behind the question. Because the question is built upon a number of prejudices they have against us and the Christian faith. And if I'm just giving the biblical answer, it will not work, because they will hear it out from their prejudices. So I think of this like there's a number of balloons, and I need to pick hole in all the balloons first before I can give the answer. The balloons represent the prejudices people have. And I need to be aware of those balloons and find ways of picking hole in it so the air comes out and it becomes a non-issue. So I would maybe say something like this. So, what do you think about homosexuality? Well, that is a very important issue. Sexuality is important for all of us, so thank you for asking. We really need to think through those kinds of issues. As a Christian, this is my way of thinking. I believe that everyone is created in the image of God. Therefore, everyone, regardless of how we identify ourselves or feel ourselves, we have dignity and worth, because I want to look upon everyone as an image bearer of God. And therefore, I reject homophobia. Secondly, as a Christian, my view is not to distinguish between people, because I have a very universal view of the brokenness of us, that we all are broken human being, we are fallen human being, we are, to use the Christian vocabulary, we are sinners, and we are all at the bottom. So a Christian can actually not look down on someone else. If you are at the bottom together with the rest of humanity, how can you look down on someone? So I don't think we can bring in contempt in those issues. Thirdly, politically, as a Christian, I am a strong advocate for a free society. I think every individual has the right to choose their own way of life. Of course, we need to have some kinds of limits. You're not allowed to hurt someone else. But I think we all can agree on that. But my general perspective here is freedom. You have the right to choose your lifestyle. I have the right to choose my lifestyle. And I will not interfere with your choices. You have genuine freedom, I think we should have, and I have genuine freedom. And we have to think through what kind of way we want to live sexually, all of us. Now, since I'm a Christian and I believe there is a creator who has created this world, of course, for me, the main issue here is, what is the will of God? What is the thinking of God in terms of our bodies, our sexualities, our relationships? So that is the focus for me. Historical Christians have had a common perspective on these issues. Christians have been thinking the same. But as many of you know, today you can hear different Christian voices on this issue. And there are two reasons why Christians are divided on this issue. The first reason is that Christian have different views of how to make the priority between what your body tells you and what your inner being tells you. So the traditional view is that if you look at the body, a male body belongs to a female body. If you look to a female body, it tells you it belongs to a male body. So when then the inner being is saying something that contradicts your body, the traditional opinion is you should go with what your body tells you. The new perspective is the opposite, that you ignore the signals of your body and you follow your own inner experience. And the second reason why Christians are divided is that there are different interpretations of the Bible. What is the right interpretation of the Bible? Does the Bible exclude same-sex relationships generally, all kinds, or is it just excluding specific cases but not loving, committed relationships? My view here is the traditional view, that we should take our bodies really seriously. And I think it's really clear that a sound interpretation of the biblical texts points towards God's will is for a male and female relationship when we think about sexuality. So you see what I've been doing here. I tried to pick hole in a number of balloons first, And then I went into the Christian answer. And then I did not give my answer, or in this case, I have the courage to say the right answer, just. But I wanted to have them to force to think about the different options here. But in the end, I hope you heard that I made a clear statement of what I think the Christian faith is saying here. You will have a chance to come back and react and criticize or comment what I'm doing here. So, secondly, what do you think about evolution? That question will come up very regularly, and we need to deal with that. So, what do you think about evolution? Well, the strategies for me here, and I guess for some of you this will, maybe my first answer was controversial, I don't know. I'm sure what I will be saying now will for some of you be controversial, but bear with me and you will have a chance to react. My main strategy here is to work with the definition of terms, to define the terms. What do we actually mean by the word evolution? And there are a number of things you could say here, but I would basically go for this. So you ask me, what do I think about evolution? But then I need to ask you, what do you mean by evolution? Because that is not actually completely clear. Are we talking about evolution as a biological mechanism that we can see going on now? Are we talking about evolution extrapolating from that processes of changes we see now, extrapolating that backwards in time as one of the key mechanisms for biological diversity, but still just talking about what's going on in biology? Or are we talking philosophy here, naturalistic evolution, that the process that the theory of evolution is proposing, that process is mindless, that there is no mind behind it, no thought behind it, no guidance behind it, no God behind it? Now, that's two very different issues. What are we talking about here? Let's assume that the current version of the theory of evolution is, by and large, give us the right picture. Let's just assume that. Is that in itself a contradiction to God? No, of course not. If there is a God, he could create life on planet Earth the way he wants to do it. He could do it immediately in 1 second. He could do it during a few days, if he wanted. He could do it through a slow process, through a nature he himself has created. So an evolutionary process could be planned, designed, guided by a personal God. The real issue here is not between God and evolution. It's between belief in God and naturalism, that there is no mind behind what's going on or what has been going on planet Earth. And as you know, a lot of Christians would describe themselves, not all, but a lot of Christians would describe themselves as theistic evolutionists. They affirm the basic picture current science gives us. So there is no contradiction between God and evolution, but there is, of course, a contradiction between a literal interpretation of Genesis and the current theory of evolution. So then there is a contradiction. But it's not between God and evolution, it's between a literal interpretation of Genesis and evolution. And then, of course, It belongs to the nature of science that all scientific results are provisional. They are not final. So, of course, regardless of what we think here about evolution, we need to be open to the question, is the Neo-Darwinian theory the complete and final picture? All of us need to be open that there might be revisions, there might be changes. We might have to change our view of this. Hope you see what I was doing. I was trying to show them the complexity of the issue, and that very often when we say evolution, we actually mean naturalistic evolution. And we need to make that clear. And this is the same with many other issues that we need to define. We need to try to understand what have they defined as the, what is their definition of the issue. And if it is not a good, a right definition, we need to help people to see how to define those issues. Notice also that I have not taken a stand here on what is actually the best interpretation of Genesis. For most non-Christians, that is not an important issue, and I'm not interested in solving it for them. I'm interested in them starting to believe in God and discover that God have revealed himself in Jesus Christ. And when they have become Christians, then we can have an interesting discussion about what is actually the right interpretation of Genesis 1. I don't feel that's my main goal, to sell the right interpretation of Genesis 1 to the non-Christians. That is an interesting issue for us as Christians mainly. The non-Christians, what I want to communicate to them is the possibility of God. To open their minds for the possibility of God and make them curious about Jesus Christ, not about the right interpretation of Genesis 1. That's a later question. Thirdly, you cannot present the gospel without having someone raising the problem of evil. Why is there so much evil in the world? If there is a God, good, almighty, why is there so much evil in the world? The strategy here is to contrast the Christian answer with the available alternatives. Not to let people come away with just the critique of one alternative and not being forced to present the options to see if there is there a better alternative. So my starting point here would be to say, yeah, this is a crucial issue. And it's an issue for all of us. Evil is a problem for all humanity. Regardless if you are an atheist or a Hindu or a Buddhist or a Christian or a Muslim, evil is there because it's part of the world and we see it's part of our own being. That we have the capacity of evil. We have selfishness within us. And there's so much horrible pain and evil outside. So it's not only me as a Christian who should answer this question. If you're an atheist, I'm really interested to hear, so what is your perspective on evil in the world? As I understand it, if you take away God, so if we begin with what is in my country the main alternative, there is no God, the universe is all there is. No God means ultimately we have no definition of good and evil. There's only nature, and nature is not good nor evil. It's not moral, it's not immoral, it's amoral, without moral. So we have no definition. We cannot even talk about evil. And this is the whole question. Why is there so much evil? And here we have the main alternative in Sweden. The logical consequences is, I cannot even raise the question. It disappears. And there is no hope, of course, that evil will be defeated and good triumph. And when evil hits me personally, there's no added strength for me to face evil and pain. I'm alone. It's a very bleak answer in my view. Atheism is not rich and wonderful in dealing with evil. It's bleak and empty. It has actually nothing to say to a suffering world. Philosophers have for a long time pointed out that even on the surface we see evil as an argument against God. If you start to think about it, it actually works the other way also. Here is a formulation, I think I have it from J.P. Moreland, philosopher and apologist from Biola. An argument from evil to God. You start with the reality of evil and you end the argument with God. So, what is evil? Well, just a common sense definition is that evil is a deviation from the way things should be. It's a deviation from the way things should be. Children shouldn't be tortured. That's not the way it should be. It's a deviation. People should not be oppressed. It's a deviation from the way it should be. A man should not physically molest his wife or his children. It's a deviation from the way it should be. Whatever we call evil, this is what we mean. It's besides the way it should be. But evil is a deviation from the way things should be. But then if evil is a deviation from the way things should be, then there is a way things should be. But if there is a way things should be, then there is a moral law that stands above us and above all human situation, telling us how it should be. But if there is a moral law, where does that come from? There must be a moral lawgiver. Then there is a moral reality above us, and a moral lawgiver is part of what we mean by God. So I hope you see the logic here. We start by saying something that shows us it's a deviation from the way things should be. But then we have affirmed there is a way things should be. But if there is a way things should be, we are confronted with a moral law. And if there is a moral law, where does that come from? There must be a moral reality, a moral lawgiver. And then we are actually reaching God. So we start with evil and come to God. I think this is an important point to press the alternatives and show here is one way to answer it, here is another way to answer it. And in almost all cases, the Christian's faith will come out much stronger than the alternative. Fourthly, if we talk about Jesus Christ, the whole issue about sources. How do we have knowledge about this historical person? How reliable are the sources we have? What about the New Testament? What about the Gospels? Are the Gospels historically reliable? And here we need to study so we have good background information, because there's so much confusion in the world around us. So we need to actually learn about antiquity and the historical sources we have from antiquity and how well the New Testament fits in there. Just one example. The Gospels, the main sources about Jesus of Nazareth, are very early sources. Scholars agree that they are first century sources. They are written, the standard view, somewhere between 30 and 60 years after the public life of Jesus. So from the 60s and onwards. It's possible to give an earlier dating, but if we just go with the kind of standard opinion, they are written from the 60s to the 90s. So they are first century sources. And that means they are really early sources. There's just a time gap of 30 years between the historical Jesus and our oldest gospel. If you look at Alexander the Great, there's a time gap of 400 years between his life and the oldest best source we have, which is Plutarch. 400 years. There's only 30 years with the Gospels. If you look at some of the Roman emperors that Tacitus wrote about, there's 100 years time gap between the emperor he's writing about and Tacitus, his text. Or if you look at the Gnostic Gospels, which the media likes to speak about, they were written between 150 and 300, the year 150 and 350. So they are removed by more than 100 years from the historical Jesus. Many of them are removed several centuries from the historical Jesus. Therefore, they have very little historical value. So the Gospels are early sources about Jesus. And we could take up many other examples of the reliability of the Gospels. Fifthly, the question of miracles. Since Western culture, to a large degree, now is secular and naturalistic, just believes in nature, miracles have become such a big problem. The resurrection of Jesus, the virgin birth of Jesus, the miracles that we are told about in the Gospels. And in order to answer that question, we need to show the importance of presuppositions, of assumptions. People just ask the questions, but miracles are impossible. Dead people don't raise from the dead. Once dead, you're always dead. So how can you believe that Jesus is still alive? He was executed, he was killed, he was dead. How can you believe in a resurrection from the dead? So I found this picture of hipster Hume. Miracles, I'm so over them. So David Hume, a major philosopher, of course, who has made so much damage in our understanding of miracles. And for some really strange reasons, his arguments have kind of been accepted for several hundred years as really good and strong arguments, even though they are not. And they have been repeatedly destroyed by philosophers. So, for example, his presupposition, his assumption is that miracles cannot happen, and he is sure of this because we have a firm and unalterable experience of the laws of nature. You see the presupposition. He assumes that the experience of the regularity of the world, for example, that dead people do not raise, that is unalterable. It cannot be changed. So he has already decided from the beginning that the regularity of nature can never have any exceptions. So he's just assuming it. He's not proving it. So we need to show that we, of course, accept the regularity of nature. But the key question here is not, is nature regular? It is. But is nature the only factor that is there? Do we live in a universe that is, to quote Francis Schaeffer, a cause and effect in a closed system? Is the cause and effect in a closed system? Or is this universe an open system of cause and effect? So you have nature with its cause and effect and regularity, but you have another factor, God, who is the creator and who upholds the system, and he cannot violate the system, but he can add things to the system. And that is what we believe about miracles. And finally, shortly, the resurrection of Jesus. One aspect is, of course, the whole issue of miracles. Another issue is presenting the bigger picture. So why do we believe Jesus rose from the dead? What is the meaning of this? We have a natural tendency to go back in history, to look at the event itself and start to argue for it was real. God raised Jesus physically. The tomb was empty. And that was what changed the disciples. And of course, we should do that. But we shouldn't miss the bigger picture here, which is that we do not believe in an isolated, wonderful event happening back there. But this is the key event for understanding world history. Like this, we need to tell the Christian story so people understand why resurrection is important. We believe this is a world created by God. But because people have rebelled against God, sin and death has invaded humanity. But God has not left us. In a very surprising way, he has decided to win us back to himself. And Jesus Christ is the key here. And when the New Testament talks about Jesus being raised from the dead, it describes him as the firstborn from the dead. It was not Lazarus who was raised earlier, who was the firstborn from death, or other people being raised from the dead according to the Bible, because they were just raised to their former life and then they died. There was nothing with real consequences happening there. Their life was just prolonged a few years and then they died and are still dead. Jesus is the firstborn from the dead. That means his resurrection is the first of something that will affect world history and everyone who belongs to him. It is about an upgrading of human existence, a new way of being human. You know, like we have softwares and then there's a lot of bugs in the software and a number of things it cannot do. And then you're receiving an upgrade. And certainly the bugs are gone and new features are added. That is what we think about the resurrection of Jesus. It's an upgrading of human life. All the sins of the bugs of sin are gone. And new features are added. And now, everyone who accepts Jesus can have an upgrade. You can upgrade your life. That's the point of the resurrection. So we look back at the real event, but we are looking forward when everyone who belongs to him will be upgraded to eternal life, to that life that he brought into the world through his resurrection. And therefore I'm here to invite you to explore Jesus Christ and connect yourself to him and get a hold of this new kind of life. So there were some examples. Conclusion, we should all grow in our understanding of the faith and its implications so we freely can discuss those kinds of issues. We need to evaluate and develop our own answers. When we have answered a question, think afterwards, was that really a good answer? Or next time, how should I answer? And we should combine passion and conviction with humility and respect for people.